Early Friday morning of this week, January 3, 2020, it was still actually January 2 here in the United States, at Baghdad International Airport in Iraq, a man exited an airplane, climbed into a waiting car. Either he was in a terrible hurry or else he was being uncharacteristically sloppy, or maybe both, because he failed to notice that there were several remote control helicopters, drones, circling the area. As his car sped down the airport service road, two of the drones fired missiles at his car. The missiles found their mark in the car, and everyone in it was instantly incinerated. The man was General Soleimani, one of the most powerful men in Iran. He was the leader of their secret force, and he was the architect of their policy in the region, their proxy wars in other countries. A former FBI agent named Ali Soufan once wrote, "Soleimani, should he be so minded, could drive his car from Tehran, the capital of Iran, to Lebanon's border with Israel without being stopped, crossing the countries of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon." Another person noted that the same route would be open for truckloads of rockets bound for Iran's main regional proxy, Hezbollah. Now, Soleimani died 3 days ago, and the world is still reeling from the shock of the targeted killing of this man, who was one of the most powerful men in Iran and very close to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And Iran and its leadership have promised harsh retaliation against the United States and the President of the United States, who ordered this killing. Now, here in America, reactions to this have been mixed, from outspoken support for the strike coming from leaders like John Bolton or Senator Lindsey Graham, to the other side of the spectrum, to people like actress Rose McGowan, who tweeted out an apology to Iran, saying, quote, "We are being held hostage by a terrorist regime. We do not know how to escape. Please do not kill us." She sort of said she might have kind of been joking or not quite thinking straight when she wrote that, but she didn't exactly apologize for saying that. So there's a lot of disagreement over what this actually means, but everyone agrees that the likelihood of an all-out war centered in the Middle East is a lot greater than it was a few weeks ago. Now, rumors of war, combined with the fact that my devotions have taken me through the book of Revelation in the past few weeks, got me thinking about things like prophecy and the end of the world. John, Ezekiel, Daniel, Paul, and even Jesus himself all had a lot to say on the subject of the end of the world and the destruction of the world as we know it. They all speak of a massive conflict between good and evil leading to an ultimate destruction of the world as we know it. They also speak of a recreation into something new to be enjoyed by those who are faithful. Many of them spoke in great detail, describing events that would take place in the future. Unfortunately for us, being detailed does not equal being easy to understand. And there's few more things more confusing than trying to understand the writings of someone from the ancient past who is predicting things that would happen in the future. A prediction can be spot on, and the prophet's understanding may be very accurate, but the words to describe it didn't exist yet in his time because the things hadn't been developed. For instance, take this description. This is in Revelation chapter 9, verses 7 to 10. "In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces." Remember, these were locusts, he said. "And their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle." And we think, what crazy kind of creature was this? The thing that strikes me the most about that description was the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. If you think about chariots, you've got the rumbling of the wheels and the galloping of the horses' hooves. And if you put those sounds together, you get very close to the sound of a helicopter. And I wonder if John saw some kind of helicopter drones or something, and that was his description, because it was like locusts. And that was the only way he knew to describe it. Or maybe all those descriptions are symbolic and mean things that are puzzles that we're supposed to understand, but if they are, the solutions to them have been lost to us. Excuse me. Now, for another example of how predictions of the future can be very accurate and at the same time very far off, listen to this prediction. This was written by a Mennonite man named M.G. Weaver in 1914. He was a historian and a genealogist. One day as he was walking across the fields of his beloved Weaverland Valley, he was thinking about the people who'd lived there in the past and the people who would live there in the future, and he imagined what people in the past would have thought of amazing inventions like the trolley car or the automobile. And then he wrote this paragraph, quote, "I now cross over into the meeting house yard, and I stand where the old schoolhouse stood. Here such men as Bishop Henry Martin, Christian and Henry Weber, and a host of others learn to read their German testaments and German hymn books. Here John Zimmerman's heavy cart with a chair fixed on it stood for the boys to make fun, and which caused some of the well-meaning brethren to protest his comfortable way of coming to meeting." Let me insert here that this John Zimmerman, at the time, it was only acceptable to come to church either by walking or by riding horseback. A cart was a very worldly luxury. But this John Zimmerman is said to have weighed over 400 pounds. Riding horseback was nearly impossible, and walking was an extreme difficulty. So he took a rough old farm cart and fastened a chair to it. It was a very ugly homemade deal, and then he could come to church. And he was put out of the church for his luxurious way of traveling. So that's what he's talking about here. Here John Zimmerman's heavy cart with a chair fixed on it stood for the boys to make fun of, when which caused some of the well-meaning brethren to protest his comfortable way of coming to meeting, thinking that he must either come on horseback or walk. A horse and cart was too much ease and something new. What would the present-day carriages at either meeting houses mean to those people who lived only 100 years ago? In 100 years more, what sort of carriages will be at Weaverland? Remember, this is written in 1914, so he's talking about right now. By that time, an automobile will be a slow, out-of-date way of going. It may be possible that men and women will then sit on a seat at their door and press a button and whizz. They will open the church door and sit in a satin cushion and sleep or doze while the minister gets ready for a sermon. Something will awaken him when the preaching begins, and at the end of it all, another button pressure will whirl them home again. Perhaps flying machines will be fast enough for the common people who are satisfied to move on a little of the slower order. Well, what would old MG think if he could see people today sitting in their reclining chairs, where the press of a button brings the preacher of their choice instantly to the giant screen in front of them? Even if he could have seen it, he wouldn't have had words to describe it. My point is that our prediction of what's important now and where the future is going is often at the same time accurate and very misguided. It's accurate in the sense that God often allows people to catch a glimpse of the future. It's misguided because we see the events in front of us as much larger than they are. Continuing to draw from that letter from M.G. Weaver, he mentioned John Zimmerman's heavy cart. The people of that day saw the battle between riding horseback and the luxury of riding in a carriage as very, very important, as a really big deal. In M.G. Weaver's day, that same battle was being fought over the carriage as opposed to the automobile. They each saw the events of their day as hugely important. And this is the first mistake we make when trying to understand the prophecies in the Bible. We see the events of our day as a much bigger deal than they actually are in the grand scheme of history. Now, I realize that this idea is directly opposed to my understanding that what just happened this week in Iraq and Iran is a big deal. Maybe these things happening right now are a big deal, and maybe it's just another blip in the complicated history of the Middle East that's going to be forgotten soon. People always think the things happening in front of their eyes are a big deal, and this has always been the case. 200, 150 years before Jesus, the Maccabees, who ruled Israel, thought that the events of their day were the fulfillment of the prophecies in Daniel and Ezekiel. the early church, the first century, saw the events of their day as the fulfillment of what was happening with the Roman Empire and its cruelty. The first Anabaptists in the 1500s, early and mid-1500s, believed that the prophecies were going to be fulfilled at that time and that Jesus was going to come to northern Germany and set up his kingdom right there. And some of them completely sold out to that idea to disastrous consequences. Look, read about the Munster Rebellion if you want to see where that belief led them. Now, in our lifetime, there have been many would-be prophets like Harold Camping, David Mead, who have made bold predictions about the end of the world based on numbers from the Bible, based on lunar and solar eclipses, based on comets, asteroids, unknown planets. On the one hand, there are predictions that God's judgment is imminent and that it's coming soon because of the wickedness of the world. On the other hand, on the left hand, are dire warnings that the activities of mankind are ruining the climate of the earth and that climate change is going to bring about the end of life as we know it. All across the board, we humans have this morbid fascination with the impending doom and imagining that. And we view the things happening to us right now as bigger than they are. We also delight in knowing, especially if we know something that nobody else knows. If we have seen the light and we've figured it out, everybody else has been duped, but I know the truth. That's a human desire to know that, and it leads people of today to latch on to something they read somewhere or some obscure writing from some ancient person that they found or some video that somebody posted on YouTube and saying, aha, I know the truth. Everybody else is deceived. That's our human tendency. And the writings, the prophetic writings in the Bible are prime, ripe, fertile ground for people to use to build those kind of things. Nevertheless, in the middle of all this, the Bible still stands unwavering, unflinching. The Bible has a lot of cryptic sayings, dark sayings. And they're just as cryptic and dark as they've always been. Now, it might be easier just to ignore what the Bible said, the prophecies, the things we don't understand, and say, well, we'll never understand it. To just set the book of Revelation aside and say, we'll never understand it. We don't know. But is that what we're supposed to do? I would tend to do that because I don't like things that I don't understand. I like to be able to, especially when I preach, I like to be able to dig into the text and know what it means. And I can't do that with many of these prophecies. So I would be tempted to just set it aside, but the Bible says things like this. Revelation 1:3, blessed is the one who reads aloud the word of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. Or even more specifically, this is from Revelation 13:18. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number. Now, I'm not going to finish the verse and tell you what number we're supposed to calculate just yet. The point here is the Bible directly tells us not only to keep the prophecy and to know it, but to calculate the prophetic numbers. Now, I'm not going to do any precise calculations this morning or give you any clear answers, and I don't want to fall again into the trap of thinking that the things going in our world are a bigger deal than they are. But I do want to look at some of the main characters of the end times as portrayed in the book of Revelation and at some of the centers of power in our world today and see if there are any parallels. For a title of the sermon, I've chosen Signs and Wondering. Now, I should say at this point, before we read, that there are many scholars who are convinced that the prophecies in Revelation were fulfilled by the Roman Empire by the end of the first century, and that everything is completed, and we read it with a preview, as John was predicting things that happened, but all of it has been completed and happened in the distant past. Now, I don't deny that there were some initial fulfillments of some of these prophecies, just as on Christmas Sunday before Christmas here, we talked about the prophecies of Isaiah and how they were partially fulfilled with the birth of Isaiah's own son. But the full fulfillment did not come until the birth of Jesus. And so it is, I believe, with the prophecies in Revelation. There were some fulfillments. There were some hints, some pictures in what happened in the Roman Empire. But the full fulfillment is yet to come. That's the perspective that I approach this book with. Now, the book of Revelation is arranged in pairs of sevens. There's seven churches, there's seven seals, there's seven trumpets, there's seven bowls of wrath. And it describes events in one sense seeming to be a literal sequence of events, like a history lesson on a timeline from the past to the future. But in another sense, the book of Revelation is cyclical, describing the same events several times from different angles. It's said that history repeats itself, so maybe the cyclical feel of Revelation is more to do with the cyclical nature of history. But it's not just an endless, ever-churning circle, as Eastern thought and Buddhism and religions like that would teach, and Hinduism. It's not just an endlessly revolving circle that goes nowhere, but it is going somewhere. It has a beginning and an end. And yes, patterns are repeated, but there's a beginning and there's an ending. History is going somewhere. I'm going to look at some of the main characters and some of the symbolism this morning. And for that, let's turn to Revelation chapter 12. We'll do a fair amount of reading, and some of these verses should be familiar to you. Revelation chapter 12. This is, the seven seals have been opened, the seven trumpets have sounded, and this is in the intervening space, sort of the fulfillment of the seventh trumpet before the beginning of the pouring out of the bowls of wrath. Revelation 12. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with seven heads and 10 horns, and on his head seven diadems or crowns. His tail swept a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Just a pause here. That 1,260 day time period is repeated over and over again in prophecies, with a 360 day year, which is how the Hebrew calendar was calculated. It's 3.5 years. It's variously expressed in a number of weeks and in the phrase a time, times, and half a time, which means a year, 2 years, and a half year, or 3.5 years. So you'll see that 1,260 days, or the time, times, and half a time expression over and over again. It's symbolic of something. And it's a symbol that's often repeated. Revelation 12:7. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they loved not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows his time is short. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time, times, and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" We'll stop reading at that point. Now, what's fascinating to me is the characters in this vision that are introduced continue through the rest of the book of Revelation, even as the scenes change and times move and things change and nations battle. The scenes, the characters that are introduced here continue on through the book of Revelation right up to the end. There's 3 primary evil characters here. There's the dragon. The dragon enters the story as a sign appearing in heaven. But the dragon very quickly becomes a literal part of the story. Now, the dragon is one of only 2 characters in the story who are directly identified. The other character who is directly identified in the story is the lamb, who's identified as Jesus. The dragon is that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. That's Revelation 12:9. He was defeated in heaven and thrown down to earth. Now I have to wonder, did this happen thousands and thousands of years ago? Or is there a much greater manifestation of Satan's power that is yet to come? Satan is certainly active in his business of deceiving the nations. The second character in the vision is the beast from the sea. This beast arises from the sea as the dragon stands on the seashore, apparently called into existence by the dragon. And the dragon gives his power to the beast for the purpose of waging war, Revelation 12:17, against those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. The manifestation of his wrath against those who are faithful to Jesus is the calling up of this beast. And as the dragon stands on the seashore, the beast comes out of the sea. This beast will conquer the saints, Revelation 13:7, and everyone whose name is not written in the book of life will worship the beast, Revelation 13:8. The third character, and this is in a section of verses that I didn't read, is the beast from the land, who is also known as the false prophet. The false prophet serves as the persuader and the enforcer for the first beast. They're both working for the dragon. The false prophet deceives the people of the earth with signs and wonders. He forces people everywhere to worship the beast and to be marked with the beast's number. And in one of the most ominous verses in the Bible, John tells us the specific number of the beast. The number is 666. You find that in Revelation 13:18. That's the number that he told us to calculate from the verse I quoted earlier at the beginning of this message. He said it calls for wisdom, and let the one who understands calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And some places, and it doesn't say it here in the ESV, but I think there's some that refer to the number of his name. Now, the most popular explanation of this, and people have been freaking out over that number ever since, the most popular explanation of this is that it refers to Nero, the emperor. If you take the title Nero Caesar, now Nero had a lot of titles, Caesar was only one of them, but if you take the name Nero Caesar and transliterate it into Hebrew, that is, write it into the Hebrew letters that would sound approximately close to that, since Hebrew has no vowels, there's fewer letters. And they say that Hebrew added an N to the end of all foreign names. Now, this feels a little bit like doing gymnastics with the spelling, but this is what they say. You get six letters, and in the Hebrew language, it is fairly well established that the letters each have number value. The first letter in the alphabet is a value of 1, second is 2, third is 3, on the way down to 10. Then the 11th letter has a value of 20, the 12th letter has a value of 30, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 200, 300. And in that way, you can use the letters to come up with any combination of numbers you want. And so they will take words and phrases and add up the letters and say what its number value is and draw meanings out of this. Now, this is admittedly a bit sketchy because you can come up with just about anything you want to with methods like that. But nevertheless, it's still the prevailing opinion that if you take the letters, the Hebrew letters that would spell Nero, Caesar, and add the value up, it comes to 666. But it's also the prevailing opinion that the book of Revelation was written 20 or so years after Nero's death. So why would the number point to a man who died 20 years ago? There does seem to have been a theory, that a belief in around Rome, that Nero would come back to life. But I have a hard time believing that John, or God speaking through John, would use that as the basis. Some say it was a cryptic way of referring to Emperor Domitian, who was persecuting the church and was similar to Nero, and it was sort of a veiled way of pointing to him. I don't know. Even if it did refer to Nero, then what does it mean for us today? Well, people find the number 666 in all kinds of places today. They find it in the letters of the Pope's headgear. If you take the Latin and use only the letters in the phrase that's inscribed on the turban, or whatever they call the thing that the Pope wears for official things, if you take the letters and take out only the letters that are part of the Roman numeral system, I, L, and X, and add their value up, it comes up to, if you do the math according to the way people do it, 666. Again, it takes some gymnastics to make it happen. People do it. People find this value in the internet with the www for World Wide Web, and they find a connection between W and either the Hebrew letter for 6 or some other ancient language that it's the 6th letter that it looks like. People find the number in the dividing lines of barcodes because the long dividing lines at the beginning end and middle of a barcode look like what you get when you put a 6 in the second half of a barcode. 6 looks different in the first half than the second half. It's not a number 6, but it looks like it. And so people see that in barcodes. People find the number 666 in the Monster Energy Drink logo because the M looks like the Hebrew letter for the value 6 repeated 3 times. People find it in the Walt Disney logo because there's 3 curly Q's in Walt Disney's signature that if you superimpose a 6 over top of it, look like 6s. Ronald Wilson Reagan, had 6 letters in each of his names. And when he left office, he moved to 666 St. Cloud Road, Bel Air, California. He promptly changed the address to 668 to remove any suspicion there. For years, Finnair flight AY666 flew from Copenhagen to Helsinki. Helsinki's airport code is HEL, so people were constantly taking flight 666 to hell. That's what it said on their tickets. And that flight often flew on Friday the 13th. Yikes. Now, many people get superstitious when they see a combination of 3 sixes. It's important to note that the number in Revelation is not 666, but 666. What's the difference? Well, there's a big difference. Because in ancient languages, whether it's Latin, Greek, or Hebrew, they did not have numerals. Like we have separate characters to represent numbers, they had the letters of the alphabet. And they would either spell out the words or use abbreviations, as we said, where the first letter is 1, the 11th letter is 20. And so to write a series of 3 sixes in Greek, as Revelation was written in, If it was 666, you would get S, S, S. But that's not what's there. What you have is X, E, S, which is 666. It's written completely different. There's no question that it was not the sequence of three sixes, but the value 666. That was the intention to be communicated here. So, that exonerates a lot of the things that people freak out about. Ronald Reagan has been exonerated. Barcodes are good to go. Walt Disney is innocent. Monster energy drinks might be bad for you for other reasons, but they're not the mark of the beast. Nor is the internet or Linux file permissions or anything else like that that I found in reading about this. Now, Nero and the Pope are still somewhat suspect, I guess. Maybe someday I'll be able to come to an answer of calculating this name. But until I do, I don't want to be swept away into fearful superstitions. And on the other hand, I don't want to be lulled into sleep, complacency, and indifference. And I pray that God will give us the wisdom to understand this when the time comes for us to know. But back to the three evil characters, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. They came into John's vision in a very symbolic manner, but they three continue to be prominent through the rest of the book of Revelation, as even as the prophecies take on a more and more literal tone. What began as a sign appearing in heaven comes out in very literal actions on the earth as the book progresses. Contrasted to these three evil characters is the Lamb, who I mentioned earlier. The Lamb clearly is Jesus Christ himself. He makes his first appearance in Revelation in the throne room in chapter 5, verse 6, as the only one who is worthy to open the scroll to unveil and release the final judgment of God. And as the seals are opened, and then as the trumpets sound, and then finally as the bowls of wrath are poured out, God's judgment on the evil of the world is completed. And the separation between the faithful who follow Jesus and those who turn away from him, the separation line is drawn. And as Revelation progresses, we see a clearer and clearer divide between good and evil. Just as Jesus said in his prophecy about the wheat and the tares, the angels come at the end of the world, and the field is harvested, and the wheat is separated from the tares. The wheat is stored in the garner, and the tares are burned up with unquenchable fire. Interesting to note that one of the manifestations of God's wrath, and we're jumping back to the end of the bowls of wrath now, is that the sun is going to scorch people with heat. Now, science understands that as a star like the sun ages, it expands greatly. Scientists will typically project that the sun will burn up the earth anywhere from 800 million to 5 billion years from now due to this. But billions of years aside, the Bible does agree with scientists that the earth will one day be burned up by the sun. Let's go back to Revelation 16. We'll read where that happens, and then continue reading to see what happens next. Revelation 16, we're going to jump in at verse 8. This is the fourth bowl of wrath. Revelation 16, 8. The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and it was allowed to scorch people with fire. They were scorched by the fierce heat, and they cursed the name of God who had power over these plagues. They did not repent and give him glory. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. People gnawed their tongues in anguish and cursed the God of heaven for their pain and sores. They did not repent of their deeds. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, or three demonic spirits, like frogs. For they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God Almighty. The same three evil characters, even though we skipped over many events in the 2.5 chapters in between where I previously read. And John was allowed to see the demonic spirits that were motivating and driving each one of them. Now, do these three evil characters have parallels in our world today? I'm not going to draw any direct parallels. I'm just going to point out some of the countries and world leaders today who would be in positions to fill some of these roles. One would be the country of Russia and the leader Vladimir Putin. Under his leadership, Russia holds sway over many other countries and has the capacity to wipe out a good portion of the earth. Putin bows, the Russian leadership bows to no god, and the leader serves no one but himself. Secondly, the country of Iran, under the militant Muslim government and leadership of Ali Khamenei. With its militant Muslim government, Iran has positioned itself as the primary enemy of Israel. Its strong alliance with Russia makes it a primary vector of attack against Israel. And the prophecy that I just read about the river Euphrates being dried up to make a path for the kings links directly to Iran. In fact, the way the river curves, if the entire river dried up, it would make a path for Iran, along with Iraq, to come from the west, southwest, and Russia, and probably Turkey, to come from the north in their attack on Israel. Turkey and its leader Erdogan are another country of interest in this study. Not because Turkey is that powerful or that big of an influencer in the world, though I think they would like to be, but because of all the geographic ties that it has. The seven churches of Revelation were all in what is now Turkey. And Erdogan has proven to be a ruthless dictator. They intensely are persecuting Christians. He has the blood of many martyrs on his hands. And if the prophecies right here are to be fulfilled sometime in the next 10 years or so, Erdogan is very likely going to be a key player. Another country that's a force in the world to be reckoned with is, of course, the United States. And directly opposed to Iran in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia and its allies with the United States. And if the nations are to meet at Armageddon or Megiddo in Israel for this grand battle, the countries from the East will need someone to fight against more than just the nation of Israel. And the United States and Saudi Arabia are positioning themselves to be the other half of that battle. And it's possible, I think, that the killing of this top Iranian general this week is the start of such a war. It's also possible that this may fade into oblivion very soon and that the fulfillment is not to come for a while. Another world power not to be forgotten about is China. China has enormous economic and military influence in the world, though their interest in Israel has seemed to be minimal up to this point. And I have a hard time seeing how they fit into the end times picture. But China has the blood of many martyrs on its hands, as does North Korea. North Korea is a small power in the global scale. But their attitude and the big things that are said by their leadership, their unique self-exaltation make them a country worth watching. And they also, again, have the blood of many martyrs on their hands. Now there's one more yet in the evil cast of characters of the end times, and that's the great prostitute Babylon. We find this character introduced in Revelation 17. This is 17:1-7. I'm going to read that. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and said, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality and the dwellers of earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly, but the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman. and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. And then he proceeds to give interpretations of this, which, though they add detail, are still difficult to understand. Much of this, again, was fulfilled with the Roman Empire, at least partially, but I think the greatest fulfillment is yet to come. One popular belief among American evangelicals is that this great prostitute is the Roman Catholic Church. That view may have made sense 600 years ago, but the Catholic Church doesn't have the influence that it once did. And it is awfully hard to imagine the great laments in Revelation 18 being sung with anything to do with the Catholic Church or the Pope. And at the risk of making out the events of our day to be more important than they really are, I'll tell you that it's my opinion that the great prostitute, at least in our day, is none other than the United States of America. When John saw this woman at the time of her judgment, she was drunk with the blood of the saints. And the United States has not yet been a focal point for martyrdom and persecution. So I think the prophecy is still some years in the future. But there are too many other similarities between the woman and America for me to allow much room to doubt this conclusion. Notice verse 4 of chapter 17. The woman holds in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. America has long been a pioneer of sexual immorality, and America invests all the energy it can into spreading its immorality to the rest of the world. Now, it's true that at the moment, there are many European countries and even Canada that are farther along the road to depravity than the United States. But no other country sells and promotes immorality as much as the United States does, especially through the medium of movies. Notice secondly, chapter 17, verse 15, the woman is seated on many waters, which are the people and multitudes and nations and languages. America has long been a melting pot of cultures, a uniting point. And America has been highly instrumental in spreading a common language across the world, along with its culture of immorality. Notice thirdly, 17, verse 18, the woman is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Sure, that was Rome when Revelation was written. But what place today has dominion over the kings of the earth? It's the United States. But the biggest thing, in my opinion, is this saying, which is repeated multiple times in various forms. Revelation 18:3, the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. Or Revelation 18:11, the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Who buys the cargo of all the merchants of the world? The United States of America. And in the end, it's this theme, which is chapter 18 of Revelation, is laments over the destruction of Babylon. And the theme of all the things, the luxurious things that the entire world shipped into this Babylon, which was bought, that points to America. There's no other country that matches the description, in my opinion. At least in our world today. This may change in the future because the prophecy, the fulfillment of the prophecy may take a different form till all's said and done. But as of today, I don't think there's any other country that matches this description. So is there going to come a time when we must, to quote the words of Revelation 18:4, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues? Should we run right now? Well, we must certainly come out of her in a spiritual sense so as to not to take part in her sins. The culture around us is constantly trying to drag us into focusing on luxury, into living for ourselves, into indulging in sexual sins of all kinds, into indecently exposing our bodies and enjoying other people who do that. I do not think the time to physically flee the country is right now. And I don't think the iniquity of America is yet full. There are still righteous people in America. And God will not destroy the righteous with the wicked. But there may come a time to flee in the future. And I am convinced there will be coming a time of persecution, intense persecution. The great prostitute is not yet drunk with the blood of the saints today, but she will be. Babylon the great prostitute is destroyed not directly by God, but by the beast on which she was riding. After the beast, and it The beast on which the prostitute rides gets confused in the language with the beast from the land, from the sea, who came earlier, whose number was 666. It gets hard to tell them apart. But after Babylon and this red scarlet beast make war with the lamb and are defeated, the beast then turns on Babylon and destroys her. And if the end of the time is to be near, if the things to be prophesied were to be filled today, I would think the most likely scenario is that Russia, Turkey, and Iran will come together and wage war in Israel against the United States and its allies. And the United States would be defeated. How does it all end? The beast and the false prophet are captured and thrown into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. This is in chapter 19. The dragon is bound and thrown into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years, and Jesus Christ reigns on the earth along with those who were killed for their faithfulness to his name. Then Satan is released and once again deceives the nations of the earth. As they march on the holy city, fire falls from heaven and destroys them, and finally Satan, the dragon, is cast into the lake of fire. Then all the dead of all time are brought before the throne and judged. This is in Revelation 20. Anyone whose name is not found in the book of life is cast into the lake of fire. Since all these things are to be thus dissolved, 2 Peter 3:11, what sort of people ought you to be? Well, first of all, is your name in the book of life? Some theologians would tell us that the book of life was written before the foundation of the world, and it is what it is, and there's no changing it. Now, Revelation does say several times that names have been written in the book of life from before the foundation of the world. But it also indicates that Jesus will or could blot out some names from the book of life. See Revelation 3:5. Revelation makes it clear that it is those who are faithful to Jesus, those who would die rather than worship the beast and the dragon, whose names are in the book of life. Will we be faithful to Jesus unto death, if that's what's asked of us? Secondly, and this is from Revelation 14:12. I want to read that verse. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Endurance. Will we worship Christ and Him only if pressured by persecution to worship someone else or something else? Obedience. Will we keep the commandments of God? Will we live holy lives in the face of the sin and depravity all around us? And faithfulness. Will we keep our faith in Jesus and live by that, or will we succumb to doubt and despair? Just a few more verses in closing. Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." And he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." He He who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." God is actively, right now, as we speak, in the process of making all things new. And even when it looks like everything is going wrong, no, exactly when everything is going wrong, God is in control. He's over it all. We can live in confidence in that, that He is about the work of making all things new. For now, for the moment, the work is in the hearts of those who believe in Jesus, soon and possibly already in progress. His work of judging the evil and pouring out His wrath will be done. I am making all things new. And then God said, "It is done." As Jesus breathed His last on the cross, He cried out, "It is finished." Jesus there used a word that means ended, completed, fulfilled. It has been finished. It is ended. Meaning the reign and rule of sin over mankind. But when God declared "it is done" in Revelation 21:6, He used not a word that means ended like Jesus did on the cross. He used a word that means beginning. It is brought into being. It has been brought into being is the color of the word that He used there. Not "it is ended," but "it is done." It has been brought into being. And He said it in the present tense. And that's the way it remains in the Bible today. It is done. And even though it's not done here on earth from our perspective, remember, from God's eternal perspective, it is done. It has already been brought into being. And these words are sure, they're trustworthy, they're faithful, they're true. And may we live in the light of this hope. Let's pray.